The Professor by Charlotte Bronte. Chapter 7. Reader, perhaps you were never in Belgium? Happily, you don't know the physiognomy of the country. You have not its lineaments defined upon your memory as I have them on mine. 3, nay, 4 pictures line the four-walled cell where are stored for me the records of the past. First, Eton. All in that picture is in far perspective, receding, diminutive, but freshly colored, green, dewy, with a spring sky piled with glittering yet showery clouds, for my childhood was not all sunshine. It had its overcast, its cold, its stormy hours. Second, that which I had just left, huge, dingy, the canvas cracked and smoked, a yellow sky, sooty clouds, no sun, no azure, the verdure of the suburb blighted and solid, a very dreary scene. Third, Belgium, and I will pause before this landscape. As to the fourth, a curtain covers it, which I may hereafter withdraw, or may not, as suits my convenience and capacity. At any rate, for the present, it must hang undisturbed. Belgium. Name unromantic and unpoetic, yet name that, whenever uttered, has in my ear a sound, in my heart an echo, such as no other assemblage of syllables, however sweet or classic, can produce. Belgium. I repeat the word, now, as I sit alone near midnight. It stirs my world of the past like a summons to resurrection. The graves unclosed, the dead are raised, thoughts, feelings, memories that slept are seen by me ascending from the clods. Haloed, most of them, but while I gaze on their vapory forms and strive to ascertain definitely their outline, the sound which wakened them dies, and they sink, each and all, like a light wreath of mist, absorbed in the mould, recalled to urns, re-sealed in monuments. Farewell, luminous phantoms. This is Belgium, reader. Look, don't call the picture a flat or a dull one. It was neither flat nor dull to me when I first beheld it. When I left Ostend on a mild February morning and found myself on the road to Brussels, nothing could look vapid to me. My sense of enjoyment possessed an edge wedded to the finest, untouched, keen, exquisite. I was young. I had good health. Pleasure and I had never met. No indulgence of hers had enervated or sated one faculty of my nature. Liberty I clasped in my arms for the first time, and the influence of her smile and embrace revived my life like the sun and the west wind. Yes, at that epoch, I felt like a morning traveller who doubts not that from the hill he is ascending he shall behold a glorious sunrise. What if the track be straight, steep, and stony? He sees it not. His eyes are fixed on that summit, flushed already, flushed and gilded, and having gained it, he is certain of the scene beyond. He knows that the sun will face him, that his chariot is even now coming over the eastern horizon, and that the herald breeze he feels on his cheek is opening for the god's career a clear, vast path of azure, amidst clouds soft as pearl and warm as flame. Difficulty and toil were to be my lot, but sustained by energy, drawn on by hopes as bright as vague, I deemed such a lot no hardship. I mounted now the hill in shade. There were pebbles, inequalities, briars in my path, but my eyes were fixed on the crimson peak above. My imagination was with the refulgent firmament beyond, and I thought nothing of the stones turning under my feet or of the thorns scratching my face and hands. I gazed often and always with delight from the window of the diligence. These, be it remembered, were not the days of trains and railroads. Well, and what did I see? I will tell you faithfully. Green reedy swamps. Fields, fertile but flat, cultivated in patches that made them look like magnified kitchen gardens. Belts of cut trees, formal as pollard willows, skirting the horizon, narrow canals gliding slow by the roadside, painted Flemish farmhouses, some very dirty hovels. A grey dead sky, wet road, wet fields, wet housetops, not a beautiful, scarcely a picturesque object met my eye along the whole route. Yet to me, all was beautiful, all was more than picturesque. It continued fair so long as daylight lasted, though the moisture of many preceding damp days had soddened the whole country. As it grew dark, however, the rain recommenced, and it was through streaming and starless darkness my eye caught the first gleam of the lights of Brussels. I saw little of the city but its lights that night. Having alighted from the diligence, a fiacre conveyed me to my hotel, where I had been advised by a fellow traveller to put up. Having eaten a traveller's supper, I retired to bed and slept a traveller's sleep. Next morning I awoke from prolonged and sound repose with the impression that I was yet in my old town, and perceiving it to be broad daylight, I started up, imagining that I had overslept myself and should be behind time at the counting-house. The momentary and painful sense of restraint vanished before the revived and reviving consciousness of freedom as, throwing back the white curtains of my bed, I looked forth into a wide, lofty foreign chamber. How different from the small and dingy, though not uncomfortable, apartment I had occupied for a night or two at a respectable inn in London while waiting for the sailing of the packet. Yet, far be it from me to profane the memory of that little dingy room. It, too, is dear to my soul, for there, as I lay in quiet and darkness, I first heard the great bell of St. Paul's telling London it was midnight, and well do I recall the deep, deliberate tones so full-charged with colossal phlegm and force. From the small, narrow window of that room I first saw the dome looming through a London mist. I suppose the sensations stirred by those first sounds, first sights, are felt but once. Treasure them, memory. Seal them in urns, and keep them in safe niches. Well, I rose. Travellers talk of the apartments in foreign dwellings being bare and uncomfortable. I thought my chamber looked stately and cheerful. It had such large windows, croisées that opened like doors, with such broad, clear panes of glass, such a great-looking glass stood on my dressing-table, such a fine mirror glinted over the mantelpiece, the painted floor looked so clean and glossy. When I had dressed and was descending the stairs, the broad marble steps almost awed me, and so did the lofty hall into which they conducted. On the first landing, I met a Flemish housemaid. She had wooden shoes, a short red petticoat, a printed cotton bedgown. Her face was broad, her physiognomy eminently stupid. When I spoke to her in French, she answered me in Flemish with an air the reverse of civil. Yet I thought her charming. If she was not pretty or polite, she was, I conceived, very picturesque. She reminded me of the female figures in certain Dutch paintings I had seen in other years at Seacombe Hall. I repaired to the public room. That, too, was very large and very lofty and warmed by a stove. The floor was black, and the stove was black, and most of the furniture was black. Yet I never experienced a freer sense of exhilaration than when I sat down at a very long black table, covered, however, in part by a white cloth, and, having ordered breakfast, began to pour out my coffee from a little black coffee pot. The stove might be dismal-looking to some eyes, not to mine, but it was indisputably very warm, and there were two gentlemen seated by it talking in French. Impossible to follow their rapid utterance or comprehend much of the purport of what they said, yet French, in the mouths of Frenchmen or Belgians, I was not then sensible of the horrors of the Belgian accent, was as music to my ears. One of these gentlemen presently discerned me to be an Englishman, no doubt from the fashion in which I addressed the waiter, for I would persist in speaking French in my execrable South of England style, though the man understood English. The gentleman, after looking towards me once or twice, politely accosted me in very good English. I remember I wished to God that I could speak French as well. His fluency and correct pronunciation impressed me for the first time with a due notion of the cosmopolitan character of the capital I was in. It was my first experience of that skill in living languages I afterwards found to be so general in Brussels. I lingered over my breakfast as long as I could while it was there on the table, and while that stranger continued talking to me, I was a free, independent traveller. But at last the things were removed, the two gentlemen left the room, suddenly the illusion ceased, reality and business came back. I, a bondsman just released from the yoke, freed for 1 week from 21 years of constraint, must of necessity resume the fetters of dependency. Hardly had I tasted the delight of being without a master when duty issued her stern mandate. Go forth and seek another service. I never linger over a painful and necessary task. I never take pleasure before business. It is not in my nature to do so. Impossible to enjoy a leisurely walk over the city, though I perceived the morning was very fine, until I had first presented Mr. Hunsdon's letter of introduction and got fairly on to the track of a new situation. Wrenching my mind from liberty and delight, I seized my hat and forced my reluctant body out of the hotel and into the foreign street. It was a fine day, but I would not look at the blue sky or at the stately houses round me. My mind was bent on one thing, finding out Mr. Brown on Rue Royale, for so my letter was addressed. By dint of inquiry, I succeeded. I stood at last at the desired door, knocked, asked for Mr. Brown, and was admitted. Being shown into a small breakfast room, I found myself in the presence of an elderly gentleman, very grave, businesslike, and respectable-looking. I presented Mr. Hunsdon's letter. He received me very civilly. After a little desultory conversation, he asked me if there was anything in which his advice or experience could be of use. I said, yes, and then proceeded to tell him that I was not a gentleman of fortune travelling for pleasure, but an ex-counting-house clerk who wanted employment of some kind, and that immediately, too. He replied that as a friend of Mr. Hunsdon's, he would be willing to assist me as well as he could. After some meditation, he named a place in a mercantile house at Liege, and another in a bookseller's shop at Louvain. "Clerk and shopman?" muttered I to myself. "No." I shook my head. I had tried the high stool. I hated it. I believed there were other occupations that would suit me better. Besides, I did not wish to leave Brussels. "I know of no place in Brussels," answered Mr. Brown, "unless indeed you are disposed to turn your attention to teaching. I am acquainted with the director of a large establishment who is in want of a professor of English and Latin." I thought 2 minutes. Then I seized the idea eagerly. "The very thing, sir," said I. "But," asked he, "do you understand French well enough to teach Belgian boys English?" Fortunately, I could answer this question in the affirmative. Having studied French under a Frenchman, I could speak the language intelligibly, though not fluently. I could also read it well and write it decently. "Then," pursued Mr. Brown, "I think I can promise you the place, for Monsieur Pellet will not refuse a professor recommended by me. But come here again at 5 o'clock this afternoon, and I will introduce you to him." The word professor struck me. "I am not a professor," said I. "Oh," returned Mr. Brown, "professor here in Belgium means a teacher. That is all." My conscience thus quieted, I thanked Mr. Brown, and for the present withdrew. This time I stepped out into the street with a relieved heart. The task I had imposed on myself for that day was executed. I might now take some hours of holiday. I felt free to look up. For the first time, I remarked the sparkling clearness of the air, the deep blue of the sky, the gay, clean aspect of the whitewashed or painted houses. I saw what a fine street was the Rue Royale, and walking leisurely along its broad pavement, I continued to survey its stately hotels, till the palisades, the gates, and trees of the park appearing in sight offered to my eye a new attraction. I remember, before entering the park, I stood a while to contemplate the statue of General Belliard, and then I advanced to the top of the great staircase just beyond, and I looked down into a narrow black street, which I afterwards learnt was called the Rue de Isabelle. I well recollect that my eye rested on the green door of a rather large house opposite, whereon a brass plate was inscribed, "Pensionnat des Demoiselles." Pensionnat. The word excited an uneasy sensation in my mind. It seemed to speak of restraint. Some of the demoiselles, externats no doubt, were at that moment issuing from the door. I looked for a pretty face amongst them, but their close little French bonnets hid their features. In a moment, they were gone. I had traversed a good deal of Brussels before 5 o'clock arrived, but punctually, as that hour struck, I was again in the Rue Royale. Readmitted to Mr. Brown's breakfast room, I found him as before seated at the table, and he was not alone. A gentleman stood by the hearth. 2 words of introduction designated him as my future master. "Monsieur Pellet, Mr. Crimsworth. Mr. Crimsworth, Monsieur Pellet." A bow on each side finished the ceremony. I don't know what sort of a bow I made, an ordinary one, I suppose, for I was in a tranquil, commonplace frame of mind. I felt none of the agitation which had troubled my first interview with Edward Crimsworth. Monsieur Pellet's bow was extremely polite, yet not theatrical, scarcely French. He and I were presently seated opposite to each other. In a pleasing voice, low, and, out of consideration to my foreign ears, very distinct and deliberate, Monsieur Pellet intimated that he had just been receiving from le respectable Monsieur Brown an account of my attainments and character which relieved him from all scruple as to the propriety of engaging me as professor of English and Latin in his establishment. Nevertheless, for form's sake, he would put a few questions to test my powers. He did, and expressed in flattering terms his satisfaction at my answers. The subject of salary came next. It was fixed at 1,000 francs per annum, besides board and lodging. And in addition, suggested Monsieur Pellet, as there will be some hours in each day during which your services will not be required in my establishment, you may in time obtain employment in other seminaries, and thus turn your vacant moments to profitable account. I thought this very kind, and indeed I found afterwards that the terms on which Monsieur Pellet had engaged me were really liberal for Brussels, instruction being extremely cheap there on account of the number of teachers. It was further arranged that I should be installed in my new post the very next day, after which Monsieur Pellet and I parted. Well, and what was he like, and what were my impressions concerning him? He was a man of about 40 years of age, of middle size and rather emaciated figure. His face was pale, his cheeks were sunk, and his eyes hollow. His features were pleasing and regular. They had a French turn, for Monsieur Pellet was no Fleming, but a Frenchman both by birth and parentage. Yet the degree of harshness inseparable from Gallic lineaments was, in his case, softened by a mild blue eye and a melancholy, almost suffering expression of countenance. His physiognomy was fine et spirituel. I use two French words because they define better than any English terms the species of intelligence with which his features were imbued. He was altogether an interesting and prepossessing personage. I wondered only at the utter absence of all the ordinary characteristics of his profession, and almost feared he could not be stern and resolute enough for a schoolmaster. Externally, at least, Monsieur Pellet presented an absolute contrast to my late master, Edward Grimsworth. Influenced by the impression I had received of his gentleness, I was a good deal surprised when, on arriving the next day at my new employer's house, and being admitted to a first view of what was to be the sphere of my future labors, namely, the large, lofty, and well-lighted schoolrooms, I beheld a numerous assemblage of pupils, boys, of course, whose collective appearance showed all the signs of a full, flourishing, and well-disciplined seminary. As I traversed the classes in company with Monsieur Pellet, a profound silence reigned on all sides, and if by chance a murmur or a whisper arose, one glance from the pensive eye of this most gentle pedagogue stilled it instantly. It was astonishing, I thought, how so mild a check could prove so effectual. When I had perambulated the length and breadth of the classes, Monsieur Pellet turned and said to me, "Would you object to taking the boys as they are and testing their proficiency in English?" The proposal was unexpected. I had thought I should have been allowed at least 3 days to prepare. But it is a bad omen to commence any career by hesitation, so I just stepped to the professor's desk near which we stood, and faced the circle of my pupils. I took a moment to collect my thoughts, and likewise to frame in French the sentence by which I proposed to open business. I made it as short as possible. "Messieurs, prenez vos livres de lecture." "Anglais ou français, monsieur?" demanded a thick-set, moon-faced young Flamand in a blouse. The answer was fortunately easy. "Anglais." I determined to give myself as little trouble as possible in this lesson. It would not do yet to trust my unpracticed tongue with the delivery of explanations. My accent and idiom would be too open to the criticisms of the young gentleman before me, relative to whom I felt already it would be necessary at once to take up an advantageous position, and I proceeded to employ means accordingly. "Commencez," cried I, when they had all produced their books. The moon-faced youth, by name Jules van der Kelkoff, as I afterwards learnt, took the first sentence. The livre de lecture was the Vicar of Wakefield, much used in foreign schools, because it is supposed to contain prime samples of conversational English. It might, however, have been a runic scroll for any resemblance the words, as enunciated by Jules, bore to the language in ordinary use amongst the natives of Great Britain. My God, how he did snuffle, snort, and wheeze! All he said was said in his throat and nose, for it is thus the Flamands speak. But I heard him to the end of his paragraph without proffering a word of correction, whereat he looked vastly self-complacent, convinced, no doubt, that he had acquitted himself like a real born and bred Anglais. In the same unmoved silence, I listened to a dozen in rotation, and when the 12th had concluded with splutter, hiss, and mumble, I solemnly laid down the book. "At a thèse," said I. There was a pause during which I regarded them all with a steady and somewhat stern gaze. A dog, if stared at hard enough and long enough, will show symptoms of embarrassment. And so at length did my bench of Belgians. Perceiving that some of the faces before me were beginning to look sullen and others ashamed, I slowly joined my hands and ejaculated in a deep voix de pointre, "Commencez à froid." They looked at each other, pouted, colored, swung their heels. They were not pleased, I saw, but they were impressed, and in the way I wished them to be. Having thus taken them down a peg in their self-conceit, the next step was to raise myself in their estimation. Not a very easy thing, considering that I hardly dared to speak for fear of betraying my own deficiencies. "Écoutez, messieurs," said I, and I endeavoured to throw into my accents the compassionate tone of a superior being who, touched by the extremity of the helplessness which at first only excited his scorn, deigns at length to bestow aid. I then began at the very beginning of the Vicar of Wakefield, and read in a slow, distinct voice some 20 pages, they all the while sitting mute and listening with fixed attention. By the time I had done, nearly an hour had elapsed. I then rose and said, "C'est assez pour aujourd'hui, messieurs. Demain nous recommencerons, et j'espère que tout ira bien." With this oracular sentence I bowed, and in company with Monsieur Pellet, quitted the schoolroom. "C'est bien, c'est très bien," said my principal as we entered his parlour. "Je vois que c'est Monsieur Adelessandre, s'il me plaît, car dans l'instruction, l'adresse est faite tout autant, quoi le savoir." From the parlour, Monsieur Pellet conducted me to my apartment, my chambre, as Monsieur said with a certain air of complacency. It was a very small room, with an excessively small bed, but Monsieur Pellet gave me to understand that I was to occupy it quite alone, which was, of course, a great comfort. Yet, though so limited in dimensions, it had two windows. Light not being taxed in Belgium, the people never grudge its admission into their houses. Just here, however, this observation is not very apropos, for one of these windows was boarded up. The open windows looked into the boys' playground. I glanced at the other, as wondering what aspect it would present if disencumbered of the boards. Monsieur Pellet read, I supposed, the expression of my eye. He explained, "La fenêtre ferme dans sur un jardin appartement à une passionnée de demoiselles," said he. "Et les convenances exigent en fin. Vous comprenez, n'est-ce pas, monsieur?" "Oui, oui," was my reply, and I looked, of course, quite satisfied. But when Monsieur Pellet had retired and closed the door after him, the first thing I did was to scrutinize closely the nailed boards, hoping to find some chink or crevice which I might enlarge and so get a peep at the consecrated ground. My researches were vain, for all the boards were well joined and strongly nailed. It is astonishing how disappointed I felt. I thought it would have been so pleasant to have looked out upon a garden planted with flowers and trees, so amusing to have watched the demoiselles at their play, to have studied female character in a variety of phases, myself the while sheltered from view by a modest muslin curtain, whereas, owing doubtless to the absurd scruples of some old duenna of a directress, I had now only the option of looking at a bare, gravelled court, with an enormous pause de géante in the middle, and the monotonous walls and windows of a boy's schoolhouse round. Not only then, but many a time after, especially in moments of weariness and low spirits, did I look with dissatisfied eyes on that most tantalizing board, longing to tear it away and get a glimpse of the green region which I imagined to lie beyond. I knew a tree grew close up to the window, for though there were as yet no leaves to rustle, I often heard at night the tapping of branches against the panes. In the daytime, when I listened attentively, I could hear, even through the boards, the voices of the demoiselles in their hours of recreation, and, to speak the honest truth, my sentimental reflections were occasionally a trifle disarranged by the not quite silvery, in fact, the too often brazen sounds, which, rising from the unseen paradise below, penetrated clamorously into my solitude. Not to mince matters, it really seemed to me a doubtful case whether the lungs of Mademoiselle Routier's girls or those of Monsieur Pellet's boys were the strongest, and when it came to shrieking, the girls indisputably beat the boys hollow. I forgot to say, by the by, that Reuter was the name of the old lady who had had my window boarded up. I say old, for such I, of course, concluded her to be, judging from her cautious, chaperone-like proceedings. Besides, nobody ever spoke of her as young. I remember I was very much amused when I first heard her Christian name. It was Zoraide, Mademoiselle Zoraide Reuteau. But the continental nations do allow themselves vagaries in the choice of names, such as we sober English never run into. I think, indeed, we have too limited a list to choose from. Meanwhile, my path was gradually growing smooth before me. I, in a few weeks, conquered the teasing difficulties inseparable from the commencement of almost every career. Ere long, I had acquired as much facility in speaking English as set me at my ease with my pupils, and, as I had encountered them on a right footing at the very beginning, and continued tenaciously to retain the advantage I had early gained, they never attempted mutiny, which circumstance, all who are in any degree acquainted with the ongoings of Belgian schools, and who know the relation in which professors and pupils too frequently stand towards each other in these establishments, will consider an important and uncommon one. Before concluding this chapter, I will say a word on the system I pursued with regard to my classes. My experience may possibly be of use to others. It did not require very keen observation to detect the character of the youth of Brabant, but it needed a certain degree of tact to adopt one's measures to their capacity. Their intellectual faculties were generally weak, their animal propensities strong. Thus, there was at once an impotence and a kind of inert force in their natures. They were dull, but they were also singularly stubborn, heavy as lead and, like lead, most difficult to move. Such being the case, it would have been truly absurd to exact from them much in the way of mental exertion. Having short memories, dense intelligence, feeble reflective powers, they recoiled with repugnance from any occupation that demanded close study or deep thought. Had the abhorred effect been extorted from them by injudicious and arbitrary measures on the part of the professor, they would have resisted as obstinately, as clamorously, as desperate swine, and though not brave singly, they were relentless, acting en masse. I understood that before my arrival in Monsieur Pellet's establishment, the combined insubordination of the pupils had effected the dismissal of more than one English master. It was necessary, then, to exact only the most moderate application from natures so little qualified to apply, to assist in every practicable way, understanding so opaque and contracted to be ever gentle, considerate, yielding even to a certain point with disposition so irrationally perverse. But, having reached that culminating point of indulgence, you must fix your foot, plant it, rooted in rock, become immutable as the towers of St. Gudule, for a step but half a step further, and you would plunge headlong into the gulf of imbecility. There lodged, you would speedily receive proofs of Flemish gratitude and magnanimity in showers of Brabant saliva and handfuls of low country mud. You might smooth to the utmost the path of learning, remove every pebble from the track, but then you must finally insist with decision on the pupil taking your arm and allowing himself to be led quietly along the prepared road. When I had brought down my lesson to the lowest level of my dullest pupil's capacity, when I had shown myself the mildest, the most tolerant of masters, a word of impertinence, a movement of disobedience, changed me at once into a despot. I offered them but one alternative, submission and acknowledgment of error, or ignominious expulsion. This system answered, and my influence by degrees became established on a firm basis. The boy is father to the man, it is said, and so I often thought when looking at my boys and remembered the political history of their ancestors. Monsieur Pellet's schools was merely an epitome of the Belgian nation. The end of chapter 7. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit to Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.